This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. For this episode, we're exploring memory with neuroscientist and author Charan Ranganath. His decades of research into how our minds really work informs his new book, Why We Remember. Joining Charan to discuss it is Alex Wilkins. Alex is a reporter for The New Scientist. Let's hear more from Alex now.
Our guest today is Charan Ranganath, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience and Director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at the University of California at Davis. For over 25 years, he has studied the mechanisms in the brain that allow us to remember past events using brain imaging techniques, computational modeling, and studies of patients with memory disorders. His new book, which we'll be discussing the themes of today, is Why We Remember, The Science of Memory and How It Shapes Us. Charan, really good to have you here, and I'm very excited to speak about your work.
Happy to be here, Alex.
So I've read a fair amount about memory in the past, and I've read kind of previous books of memory, and I've written about memory, but there was really so much here that has reshaped the way I thought about it all. And I wanted to start off by asking what your personal relationship with memory is. Despite all the kind of similarities and underlying neuroscience and underlying structures in the brain that everyone shares, it seems like people's memories can actually work in really quite radically different ways. And I wanted to ask, how do you feel your memory works? Do you think it's typical? Do you think you have a normal relationship with memory as other people do?
Well, the more I've talked to people, the more I realize how much diversity there is in the experience of remembering and the quality of remembering. So for me personally, I've always thought of myself as somebody with a poor memory. But then again, I looked back as I was writing the book and thought about how I never really struggled in school. But yet, when I remember events from my life, they tend to be very blurry, and I tend to struggle more. And so it's a very odd balance, because do I have a good memory? Well, it doesn't seem to impede my success in life, so to speak. But I do have issues when it comes to remembering some things and being able to relive them, especially. And I'm horrible with names and faces. So it's become clear to me how I have to put on my memory researcher hat in my own life and apply the same things I talk in the book about to myself.
I find that really interesting. And I also sometimes struggle with certain things like remembering events and then being a bit hazy a few years later. And I think that's almost kind of a reason that I'm so interested in memory, and the sounds like you are too. It might help listeners a little bit who know less about memory to talk about the different kinds of memories. Although our conscious experience is really good at stitching it all together and making it seem like one thing, one of the take-home messages of the book is that memory isn't just one thing, but really varied. Could you give us a rundown of the different kinds of memory that we experience and the differences there?
Yeah. And I think just to preface this, I'll say that, in fact, as you pointed out, in our daily life, often these kinds of memories are connected with each other. And I'll try to describe that as well as the differences. So one of the distinctions I talk about many times in the book is the distinction between what's called semantic memory and episodic memory. And episodic memory is our ability to remember something that happened just once, to be able to travel back in time to a particular moment that happened in a particular context. And this is different from semantic memory, which is your knowledge about the world. And this knowledge can be something that you can take with you in many different contexts so that you can apply it in new situations. And so, again, episodic memory involves a lot of bits and pieces and fragments of our past experience. It's never complete, but it relies on this kind of connective tissue of semantic memory, because what we do is we use semantic memory to fill in the blanks and the gaps between the things that we didn't remember from the past. So there's those two kinds of memories. There's also the kind of memory that allows us to become more fluent in whatever it is we're doing, whether it's, you know, hearing words or whether it's seeing things in front of us. And that can give us a sense of familiarity, which is another thing that I've studied in my lab. And then the last one I'll mention, although we can certainly slice and dice in many other ways, but the last one I'll mention is what's called procedural memory. So it's your ability to learn new skills, for instance, and that can be dissociated from memory for events as well. Finally, I'll just say that in many of these kinds of situations, our emotions can modulate memory, meaning that it can strengthen or change the way we remember something. And that emotional modulation can be separate from the actual memory of what happened.
Thank you. That was a good overview. As you kind of imply, our memory and the way it works is very different to how maybe computers and machines store information. And in the book, you write a little bit about how this makes sense given our evolutionary history and the things we were trying to kind of avoid as we were evolving as a species. I wondered kind of how much do you think that explains memory and what we see as memory today? Do you think we can entirely place the different forms of memory we see today as what was necessary for our survival? Or do you think there are other parts as well? Like how much can we consider this from like an evolutionary perspective?
I think that almost everything in biology can be talked about in the context of what was necessary for our survival, although often we don't know what that is exactly. It's hard to reverse engineer evolution. But in particular with memory, I think there's just some fairly obvious facets that come to mind. So for one is, if you look at the things that we tend to remember, the events that just kind of come in effortlessly into memory, they tend to be ones that are associated with biological importance. So moments when we're facing a threat, or moments when we're under stress, moments that are associated with rewards or attachment like love. These are the things that we tend to remember. And I think that makes sense because to survive, you need to avoid threats. You need to obtain food and water. You need to be able to form social bonds if you're a human. And all of these factors are critical for survival. So, and we can see in the biology of memory that there are certain chemicals in the brain, like serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, that are released during these key moments.
And are there things that kind of don't fit in with that evolutionary framework? Are there capabilities that we have with our memories where you can look at what we might have encountered thousands of years ago and think, well, why do we have that? And why do we have these aspects of our memory?
Well, there's definitely aspects of memory that are hard to cast in an evolutionary lens. So, for instance, I hear a lot, why is it that I can remember something about a football match that I saw 10 years ago, but I can't remember someone's name, or I can't remember where I put my keys? And again, in these daily kinds of memory interactions, it's harder to see the survival value there. But I would argue even in those cases, there's probably some tiny bit going on. For instance, just our brains seem to also prefer information that's novel for episodic memory and information that's surprising. And then there's information that elicits our curiosity. Now, a lot of those factors of what's surprising, new, and elicit our curiosity are things that, you know, maybe in our history might have been biologically important, but now might be quite trivial and unimportant.
Another thing that became really clear while reading the book is that not only is memory not one thing, but also it doesn't even live in one particular place in the brain. It feels like it's continuous and it feels like it's this one experience, but it's actually spread and coordinated through many different brain structures. I realize this might be difficult to get across in a short answer, and I don't envy this task for you, but you spend considerable effort in the book building up the picture really carefully. Could you give listeners a rough guide to the different parts of the brain, some of which they might have heard of, like the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, and the others that maybe are less well known, and how they kind of work together to give us different forms of memory?
Well, as you mentioned, the hippocampus is an area that many people have heard about, I think, in the context of, for instance, HM or Henry Molson, who is probably the most famous patient in the history of neuroscience, who was a patient who had the hippocampus. Actually, in truth, he didn't have his entire hippocampus removed, but much of his hippocampus removed in both hemispheres. And what they found was that he was unable to form new episodic memories. And he was also unable to build new knowledge out of episodic memories. And so this pointed us to the idea that the hippocampus is especially important for episodic memories. And as I describe in the book, the hippocampus isn't working alone. You have another area, which is the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is actually a whole set of areas of the brain that are involved in shaping our memories and allowing us to pull up what's useful in memory. It basically is what allows us to work with memory in a way that aligns with our goals. So when we get older, for instance, the prefrontal cortex deteriorates a little bit in its function, and our memories become less goal focused, and we find ourselves remembering things that are inane at the expense of what's relevant or important. So that's another area. There's an area called the amygdala, which is especially important for remembering things that are, again, motivationally significant. So it could be things that we're scared of. And I think many people have heard about the association between the amygdala and fear. But there can also be things like things that are rewarding, things that are surprising. And again, the amygdala is adding that hot sauce to our memories, allowing us to feel the past as opposed to just experience it. And finally, I talk about some relative newcomers in the area of memory, which is a set of areas called the default mode network, which we've argued in our research is responsible for us being able to pull out schemas or the general templates that we have in our brains for different kinds of events that we can use to efficiently form and recall memories.
And something that I really liked the idea of in the book was how all of these parts of the brain, some more than others, allow us to do what you call, or I'm not sure if it's your term or if it's another researcher, but mental time travel. So going back to previous times in your life and the parts of your brain actually activate that might have been activated at that time. This might be a surprising concept to people who thought time travel was impossible. Could you explain to us how mental time travel works and what is happening there?
So the psychologist Endel Tulving, who first coined the term episodic memory, a few years after he proposed this idea that we have a system in our brain for remembering events that occurred once in a particular time and place, he said that when we recall an episodic memory, it's an act of mental time travel, meaning that you get this feeling that you've actually re-experienced the past, that is, that you're actually replaying the past in some ways. And so what he meant by this is, for instance, if you're recalling a family vacation that you might have taken, say, to, for me, it might be Hawaii or something. And so my recalling that event is not just the ability to recall what happened, but to give myself the sense of pastness that goes with it. It's associated with that context. And so things that are uniquely associated with that place and time, like music or smells or sights that really bring you back to that event, they allow you to travel back in time. And we can see this in the brain in some of our research and other people's research, where you can see changes in brain activity that reset somewhat to what it was like at that place in time. And what that allows us to do is, because it's a form of mental time travel, it doesn't just allow us to find the memory that we were looking for, but other memories from that time and place can also come flooding back as well. The other reason why Tulving called it mental time travel was he said that we can use episodic memory not only to transport us backwards, but also forward. And he even studied a patient with amnesia who actually, so he had a memory disorder. He couldn't form new episodic memories, but he also couldn't project how things could go in the future. And so it became clear that episodic memory was not only something that's an archive of the past, but really also a resource that allows us to simulate possible futures. And so this kind of an act of mental time travel allows us to see what's ahead. And again, this points to the evolutionary function of episodic memory, to take what has happened and transform that into what could happen.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Fascinating. And I found that last point about predicting what might happen in the future really prescient, because we've seen in the past 10, 20 years this idea of the brain as a prediction machine and something that kind of predicts the world out there and then adjusts its predictions as to the data that it receives has really gained a lot of traction. So it seems like that idea was a very modern one and is really supported by the evidence, it seems.
Yes. And I think this idea of memory is a tool for prediction, it's a very powerful idea, because again, it teaches us that memory is not about the past. It's really about taking what's useful about the past. And so that partly explains why memory is so selective, because we don't want to carry everything with us. We want to carry what's likely to be useful in the future. Although our brains don't always know what's going to be useful, but I think that's a big part of it. And what's interesting is that memory also, because we're using it to generate predictions, it also orients us to what's new. Because if I'm expecting something and then information comes in that deviates from my expectations, well, then now I'm surprised. And that is the most useful information to take in to form a new memory with. So there's this beautiful, elegant cycle that we have of taking the past, generating predictions with it, but not just generating predictions passively, but using those predictions to guide where we're going to go with our attention, what we're going to expect. And then when things deviate from that, we take that information and we form that into a new memory.
Really fascinating stuff. One thing I really liked about the book was your incorporation of stories and a narrative in there. And it actually really helped me remember some of the facts that you were putting forward. It also seems something really important for how memory works in general. And I just wonder kind of what relationship does storytelling have to memory? And I guess a wider point, what relationship does memory have to creativity?
Well, so storytelling, I mean, first of all, you can think of it just in terms of even just the importance of language. I mean, so much of our spoken conversations with other people involve storytelling. And so we can get to this later, but it points to the role of memory in just our huge importance of social interactions. But if we go back to your question, I think one of the important aspects of memory that people don't realize is that when we recall the past, actually, there was a famous British psychologist named Frederick Bartlett who first made this argument that when we recall the past, we don't actually replay what happened as it happened. We get little bits, little fragments of the past, and then we imagine how it could have been. And so this imagination comes from our semantic memory. It comes from our knowledge about what could happen. But that, plus these little bits that we recover, allow us to create a story, a narrative of what had happened in the past. And these narratives are hugely important for reconstructing the past. But likewise, we can use memory, both episodic and semantic, to imagine things that have never happened. And when you look at brain activity, when people imagine things that have never happened to them, what you find is it's very similar to brain activity that happens when people recall the past. In fact, many of us who've been looking at brain images for a long time would be hard pressed to just look at a brain image and tell the difference whether somebody's recalling an event versus imagining something. And so I think this points to the huge importance of memory to imagination. What's beautiful about that is you have a very different lived experience than I do. We each have our own episodic memories that are unique to us. Somebody you lived next to when you were in college who you didn't plan for, it just happened, right? Or somebody who happens to be a colleague at work. These little random coincidences that we have allow us to draw from unique experiences and to create things that are unique to us.
And you mentioned at the beginning there that not only is storytelling a creative act, but it's also a social act. And that was one of my favorite parts of the book, was when you start talking about collective memory. I often think about some of my memories that I shared with friends that I grew up with, and friends that I've grown apart from, that maybe I've lost some certain memories, and how you meet a friend you haven't seen in ages and it kind of unlocks entire parts of your brain. But you write about how it goes much deeper than this and how it's really collective on many different levels. How much can we call collective memory as kind of in the ways that we've been speaking about it so far, and how important is it as a kind of a faculty of our brain?
Well, I would argue that if you look at memory in the context of the human experience, almost all of it is collective in some way or another. And what I mean by that is that we're so intricately involved in our social worlds that so many of the important experiences that we have are shared with other people. And once I share a memory with someone else, it becomes transformed. And it becomes transformed in two ways. One is that I actually shape my narrative to communicate something to you. And that changes the memory because the act of recalling a memory can change it. And this has all sorts of consequences that we can discuss. But then on top of it, you give me your feedback. You restate that information from your own perspective. And now that information has shaped my narrative further because the feedback that I get from you, from your own perspective, now changes my relationship with that memory, even if it's just a little bit. But what's fascinating is now you have a memory for the story I told you. This is something you've never experienced firsthand, but through my sharing that, now you have a memory. So this is just a microcosm of how the collective nature of memory works, right? And we can take that and then apply it to our lives and say, hey, I had something terrible happen to me, but now I've told this story to 100 different people. And I can actually make a humorous anecdote out of it. So I always like to say there's no point in having something terrible happen to you if you don't have a good memory out of it, or if you don't have a funny story to tell out of the whole experience. So that's one part of it. But then there's another part of it, which is, say, you and I watch the same political debate and we have the same kinds of political values. Well, now we have a shared memory, but we might exchange ideas about that political debate that we saw. And on top of that collective experience of having experienced the same thing, we've communicated that to each other. And that can reinforce our beliefs and give us a sense of also social bonding. And so we, as members of cultures, as members of societies, we have all of these shared memories that give us a sense of who we are at the cultural and national level.
One thing that I really liked how different your book was that you didn't have a list of things where you said, this is how to make your memory better and this is how to improve your memory, although you did kind of talk about that at some points. And I think some people would be interested to hear from you the most, kind of as someone who's studied this for your whole career, like how can they improve their memories, and based on what we know about neuroscience and the way the brain works, what can we do to make our memories better?
I definitely did not set out to write a self-help book, and the reason is I felt like there's many books that actually do that and do that very well. But one of the things that I wanted people to really think about is, what does it mean to have a good memory in the first place? And what I would argue is that you don't want to have a memory for everything. You want to be selective. Just as I would, if I were to go to your house, let's say, I wouldn't complain and say, well, why aren't you hoarding everything? Why don't you just fill? You have all this empty space in your house. Why aren't you filling it wall to wall with everything that you've ever encountered? And of course, that makes no sense. You want to have a place that's organized and clean and you can find things when you need it, right? And the same is true, I believe, of memory. But that said, obviously, we do have to remember things. And so one of the aspects, there's a few different memory strategies that you can use for different kinds of problems, but most strategies fall into a few different camps. And so one general piece of advice I can give is that you want to plant cues. And what I mean by this is sometimes we have to search for information in memory. And that's very difficult because it makes it more effortful. It requires more time. It's tiring to recall things when you need it. But if you have a cue, something that's out there in the environment that you're likely to encounter, that can actually activate the memory for you. And again, what's beautiful about humans is we can imagine things that we haven't actually seen, right? So I can plant a cue for remembering to do things in the future, which is very hard. So I can say, okay, it's trash day, so I have to put out the rubbish bins from the house. And so I can visualize myself going home and visualize myself being at the door. And rather than opening the door, turning around, let's say 90 degrees and looking outside and recalling that I will need to take out the trash. Now, what happens is when I go to the door, the door, instead of being just something that I pass by as I walk in, it becomes a cue that serves as a lifeline, just pulling up that memory. And then that memory allows me to do something. And you can find cues like this all over the place. You can find cues in a face that helps you pull up a name, or you can find a cue that allows you to remember where you parked your car. And most mnemonic strategies involve something like this.
That was really helpful. Thank you. We've covered a huge amount of ground, both in this interview and also in the book. It's like a whistle stop tour through all the modern areas of modern psychological research and neuroscience. I wondered kind of if there was a take-home message from the book that you want people to understand about memory or about how memory interfaces with other parts of the brain, what would you say that message is?
I would say that memory is about the present and the future, not about the past. And so it's not going to be just some passive thing that we pull out when we want to reminisce. It's actually something that's influencing our decisions, our choices, our very view. It's the prism through which we understand who we are. It's a prism through which we see the present. And it's our view of the possible futures we can have. And so I would tell people that you really want to be aware of that influence, because if you're not aware of it, it can manifest in terms of biases. It can lead us to have traumatic experiences that we can't get past. But if we view it as a resource, we can actually learn from our past mistakes. We can actually use memory in a way that actually enhances our quality of life. And I would argue that we can even use memory, the fact that memory is so important for our decisions, to be more mindful of the choices we make, not just so that we enjoy the present, but be mindful of the memories we're going to be making in the moment, so that later on we can look back at the past year and have a rich set of memories that we want to be able to pull up.
Brilliant. Well, I've learned so much from both reading the book and speaking with you. So thank you so much for joining us, Sharon. That was fascinating.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate so much that you were able to get so much out of the book.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank Sharon for a fascinating conversation. The book, once again, is Why We Remember, The Science of Memory and How It Shapes Us, and is available now from your local bookshop. I'm Alex Wilkins, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by myself, Connor Boyle, and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue, featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.